This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Today's first guest, singer-songwriter Nick Cave, just started a new North American tour. Nick Cave is famous for his dark songs and for his rough voice, which brings out all the dark colors in those songs. In an article about him in Entertainment Weekly, Chris Nashawaty wrote, quote, "Over the years, Cave's songwriting has become more intricate and challenging, almost literary in its ambitions. He's one of the few artists in rock and roll who's managed to get better with age," unquote. Cave grew up in Australia and now lives in England. He wrote the screenplay for the bloody Western, The Proposition, and co-wrote the score for that film and for another Western, the 2007 movie, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. Terry spoke with Nick Cave earlier this year when Dig Lazarus Dig was released. Here's the title track.
Larry made his nest up in the autumn branches, built from nothing but high hopes and thin air. Collected up some baby blasted mothers. They took their chances, and for a while they lived quite happily up there. He came from New York City, man, but he couldn't take the pace, and thought it was like a dog-eat-dog world. Then he went to San Francisco, spent a year in outer space with a sweet little San Franciscan girl. I can hear my mother wailing and a whole lot of scraping of chairs. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on upstairs.
Nick Cave, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me the story behind writing that song. What made you think about writing a song that refers to Lazarus?
I think I was getting some kind of revenge on my religious upbringing. I was particularly, as a child, it worried me a lot, that particular story, that Christ's greatest miracle was actually bringing someone back from the dead. And that kind of, as a child, creeped me out somewhat, to be honest. It didn't exactly traumatize me, but it felt kind of nice to sort of redress that in some kind of way and write a song about it. So I basically took the biblical Lazarus and dropped him in New York City and kind of a half comical look at what would happen to him in the contemporary world.
You said that you see the song as revenge for your religious upbringing. So many of your songs refer, you know, have biblical references or references to Jesus or God, and some in a more straightforward way, some in a more elliptical way, some in a comic way, some in a cynical way, some in a searching or loving way. Was that always true of your songs, or is this something more recent?
I think it was always true. I can remember as very young writing poetry, and the stories from the Bible always played there was always a strong element of that, even in my very, very early poetry, which I'm not going to
recite for us
recite
now.
Recite for on radio, but there was a kind of fascination. There was a fascination when I was, you know, I was a choir boy at school and at the cathedral that I went to, and I had to go to church maybe three times a week for about 3 or 4 years, and I was actually kind of interested. Especially in the biblical stories.
How old were you when you started reading the Bible?
I kind of got into the Bible because I went to art school and became very interested in religious painting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was because I understood the stories. I knew what those paintings were about, and I took a great interest in them. And then I think after that I started to kind of read, particularly the Old Testament, a lot. And I did that for quite a few years, and that had a huge influence over the way I saw the world, really, and also the songs that I wrote at that time. You know, and then I kind of gave that up and looked at the New Testament after a while.
But what's the difference between your Old Testament and your New Testament songs?
Well, I think that there's a kind of more humanistic approach to the characters in my songs, more a forgiving approach to the narratives.
Well, I want to play another track from your new CD, Dig Lazarus Dig, and this one also has a Jesus reference to it. It's called Jesus of the Moon. It's a beautiful song. I mean, it's a love song. Would you talk a little bit about writing this song?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that this particular record, Dig Lazarus Dig, despite the title, is probably the least obsessed or religiously obsessed record I made in years. It's really not about that. And there is a song called Jesus of the Moon, really, but I just felt it was a kind of nifty way of describing a sleeping woman. But it's I guess the reason why it's on the record, this particular song, is that it felt like, to me, a kind of fresh take for me on the leaving a woman type of song that I often write. There seemed to be a kind of rebirth in the whole thing that sounded kind of nice to me.
Oh, I think it's a great song. Let's hear it. This is Jesus of the Moon from Nick Cave's new CD, which is called Dig Lazarus Dig.
I stepped out of the St. James Hotel. I left you behind, curled up like a child. Change is gonna come. The door whispered shut. I walked on down the high windowed hall. You lay sleeping on the unmade bed. The weatherman on the television in the St. James Hotel said that the rains are gonna come. And I stepped out on the streets, all sparkling clean with the early morning dew. Maybe it was you and maybe it was me. You came on like a punch in the heart. Lying there with the light on your hair, like a Jesus of the moon, a Jesus of the planets and the stars.
That's Nick Cave's song, Jesus of the Moon, from his new CD, Dig Lazarus Dig. You said that this was your least biblically obsessed record, in spite of the fact that we've heard two Bible or Jesus-related songs. But there's also a song on here called We Call Upon the Author to Explain. That's kind of like, you know, asking God to explain why life and the earth are such a mess.
Yeah, well, it is. Well, yeah, I mean, you're kind of choosing three songs, really, that deal with that sort of thing. But the rest of the stuff doesn't. Although I'm sure you're going to pull out another song and say, "Oh, hang on about that song." But it actually felt to me while I was writing it that I was onto something different.
Mm-hmm,
it
mm-hmm.
really felt, and it took me a lot of time to get there. Usually, I can spend a few weeks in the office where I write. Kind of anguishing over things, and I kind of get this out of my system and find something new to write about. This took a long time. This record took a long time to write and to find something new to talk about and a new way of using words, which I'm always kind of searching for. So I felt that it was very much a departure. But I guess at the same time, I have certain themes that I always come back to, and I guess I try and look at them from different, you know, vantage points.
You live in England now, but you grew up in Australia. Would you describe the town you grew up in?
It's called Wangaratta. I mean, it's about 18,000 people, and it was, but with very much a kind of small town mentality. And to be honest, I was quite happy to get out of there.
Because?
Well, it was very restrictive, and all the stuff that I find difficult with Australia is amplified a thousandfold in these small towns. And that's if you kind of stick your head too high above the parapet, it gets lopped off, if you understand what I mean. Everyone has to be kind of the same, you know, and hunker down. And I wasn't kind of interested in that. So it was quite difficult for me. It was quite difficult for my family in general, actually.
It was hard for me to imagine you fitting into a place like that.
Well, I didn't. And I got sent to Melbourne when I was about 12. It just wasn't working out in this town for me.
Sent to a boarding school
in Melbourne.
Did you have access either in Wangaratta or in Melbourne, to the movies and music and books that eventually meant a lot to you?
Well, I did. You know, I mean, when I was 9 or 10, we got the Johnny Cash Show, for example, Australia. That was shown in Australia mm-hmm. on a weekly basis. So I watched that, and that had a huge impact on me. My brother, who was 4 years older, was very into music and listened to a lot of kind of great music. And so I was very much influenced by what he listened to. A lot of English progressive music, you know. So, you know, I was around music a lot.
What impact did Johnny Cash have on you?
Well, I remember distinctly watching the Johnny Cash Show and my ideas about what music could be changing. You know, the gears kind of shifted, and something happened with the whole chemistry. My whole chemistry kind of changed watching that. There was something that I didn't really understand then, I guess, but that was so kind of edgy about that particular show.
And Johnny Cash himself, you know, in addition to his just incredibly moving voice, he was able to sing both about the spiritual and do really convincing murder ballads and revenge ballads.
Yeah, I mean, the way I looked at him when I was young was that he was an outlaw. You know, I'm talking about a young boy who was 9 or 10 watching this kind of stuff. But he seemed like that. It seemed like that rock and roll or music could be an outlaw kind of thing that operated on the periphery of society in some way. I've now since watched those shows on DVD, actually, recently, the Johnny Cash shows, and they're extraordinary.
Did Johnny Cash in a way help point the direction for you to music that both had a really dark and a really spiritual component?
I think absolutely. You know, I mean, the records that I had before that were the Tijuana, Herb Albert Tijuana Brass records. And I bought one of them, and then I went out and bought another one. So they were the first two records I ever bought.
That's really
and
funny.
You know, but I didn't know, you know, I was in this country town, and there was something about that kind of music that I liked. But Johnny Cash kind of changed all that.
We were talking before about how, you know, you grew up in Australia in a small rural town, ended up having real problems, where you were sent to a boarding school. You had been in the choir, in the church choir, and then ended up, of course, in a band. When you started performing, did you create a stage persona for yourself? Did you kind of refashion yourself to be Nick Cave, the performer?
No, I don't think I did that consciously. But the thing about performing for me, I feel very much that I can be that person I always wanted to be. And there's something that's still very much about that to me. When I go on stage and I'm involved in the music and I hear the band playing and lose myself in the songs, I do lose myself and go to some other place, and it's and I feel that I become someone different. I don't think that it's a persona so much as I'm kind of lifted up to be the kind of person that I'd always wanted to be.
And who is that person compared to the person you think?
Well, it's kind of godlike, you know. It's not that ordinary person. And you go off stage and then suddenly you're that ordinary person again, you know. I mean, I remember that from far back as I can remember, really. But especially as a young boy, you know, I would listen to music and I'd pretend I was singing it, and I would imagine being on stage and singing this stuff to the crowds and all of that kind of thing, you know. And I would go into this other world, this alternate world. But I'm the way of kind of rock person should be, which is kind of half cartoon character, you know. It's kind of necessary. We should be seen from afar, you know, and be able to be drawn in broad strokes. And I think I've kind of managed that.
Now, we talked a little earlier about growing up in Australia, and one of the things about Australia is that, you know, the white people there basically came to start a penal colony. And you wrote the screenplay for the film The Proposition, which relates to that. And you wrote the score. You co-wrote the score for it, too. So we're going to hear the title clip, so to speak, the title scene in which the police captain actually makes the proposition. But set the scene for us. This is very early on in the film. Just summarize for us what's brought us to this point.
Well, the film opens with the kind of obliteration of the Burns gang by the police in a horrible kind of gunfight. And the two brothers, there's three brothers, but two of them have been captured. Mikey, which is the little one, and Charlie, which is the main character of the film. And the police chief presents these two brothers with a proposition in regard to Arthur Burns, a kind of renegade brother who has departed from the gang some time before and is living up in the hills. And what you will hear now is the proposition.
I wish to present you with a proposition. I know where Arthur Burns is. It is a godforsaken place. The blacks won't go there, not the trackers, not even my own men. I suppose in time the bounty hunters will get him. But I have other plans. I aim to bring him down. I aim to show that he is a man like any other. I aim to hurt him.
When you're ready, sir.
And what will most hurt him? Well, I thought long and hard about that. And I've realized, Mr. Burns, that I must become a little more inventive in my methods. Now, don't speak, Mr. Burns. Listen to me now. Don't say a word. I suppose I told you there was a way to save your little brother, Mikey, from the noose. Suppose I gave you a horse and a gun. Suppose, Mr. Burns, I was to give both you and your young brother Mikey here a pardon.
Suppose I said that I could give you the chance to expunge the guilt beneath which you so clearly labor. Suppose I gave you till Christmas. I suppose you tell me what it is I want from you.
You want me to kill me, brother?
I want you to kill your brother.
Arthur Burns is a monster. An abomination. You were right to part company with him.
It's Ray Winstone in a scene from The Proposition, which was written by my guest Nick Cave, who also co-wrote the score. That must be pretty exciting to write the screenplay and the music for a movie. It's a very brutal film and again relates to the origins of Australia as a penal colony. Since you are interested in like murder ballads and revenge and songs about those themes, are you particularly interested in the penal colony origins of your country of origin?
I mean, we all are. All Australians are, to a degree. I mean, for a long time we were, as a country, was considered a kind of shameful aspect to our heritage. You know the fact that we come from colonial stock and that we were prisoners initially and criminals. But I think that's kind of largely changed, and we're more kind of accepting of that these days.
Do you feel like when you were younger, you were into a kind of intentionally, like, transgressive image, and that as you've gotten older, that's just kind of changed, and the way you live life has changed?
Yeah, the way I live life has changed. I don't think I particularly had any kind of image. I was just the way that I was and interested in the things that I was at that particular time. I don't feel that there's much of a logic to the kind of trajectory of my life. It's just gone the way it has. At the moment, it feels strong. It feels strong, and that's a really nice feeling to have, especially creatively.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. Bryan Cranston, who stars in the AMC cable series Breaking Bad, just won the Emmy for Best Actor in a Drama Series, beating out, among others, Hugh Laurie of House, James Spader of Boston Legal, and John Hamm of Mad Men. Cranston has been around Hollywood since the 1970s, moving from guest spots to supporting roles, and from comedies to dramas, and back again. He's best known as Hal, the childlike father on Malcolm in the Middle. But you might also recognize him as Jerry's dentist on Seinfeld, as Agent Stan Grossman in Little Miss Sunshine, or as a guy with a severe headache problem on The X-Files. But earlier this year, Bryan Cranston got his first dramatic series lead, the one that earned him an Emmy. In AMC's Breaking Bad, created by Vince Gilligan, Cranston stars as Walter White, a shy high school chemistry teacher with a pregnant wife, a teen son, and a problem making ends meet. When Walter learns he has inoperable lung cancer, something in him snaps, and he decides to provide for his family the best way he knows how. He teams up with a former student to make and sell crystal meth. It's a very unlikely premise for a TV series, and Bryan Cranston, at first glance, might seem like a very unlikely leading man. I spoke with Bryan Cranston earlier this year when Breaking Bad premiered on AMC. I asked him to talk about the evolution of the show and of his career. Bryan Cranston, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
I want to start with a clip from Breaking Bad, because for people who haven't seen the show yet, this will give them a sense of what you're doing and how you're doing it. I'm fascinated by your acting as Walter White, because for most of the show, you say so little but convey so much. This is a scene where you're going to come downstairs and walk in on your wife, who's played by Anna Gunn from Deadwood, when she's on the phone making an appointment for you with a cancer specialist.
Yeah, any time on Friday is absolutely fine. Thank you so much for working us in. Can I just put that on a credit card? Great. Perfect. Okay, so we will see you at 10:45 on Friday morning. Thank you so much. Okay. Honey, the best oncologist. I mean, not even just in New Mexico, but one of the top 10 in the entire nation. His name is Dr. Del Cavoli, and we see him on Friday. I mean, Marie really came through for us. She had her boss call, and... Okay. This is good. From here on out, I mean, things are going to...
What's that we're putting on a credit card?
It's just a deposit kind of thing.
How much of a deposit?
It's $5,000.
$5,000? Jesus. And what's that, just to start? I mean, just to tell me what I already know?
I have to be honest, Bryan, when I heard the premise for this series, I didn't think I'd like the character or the show very much. Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about crystal meth, we're talking about cancer. But you really pulled me in. I still wasn't sure when the hour was over what to think of this guy. And I'm wondering, is that the only script that you saw when you had to decide whether to accept the part or not?
Yes, the only thing I saw was the pilot script. And as an actor, you know... If it starts to seep into your soul and you start daydreaming about the character and having nighttime dreams about the character, then it's becoming you, or you're becoming it, one way or the other. And when I had my first meeting with Vince a year and a half ago, I couldn't help but start saying exactly what I felt about him. This is, I think he should be a little pudgy. I think he should be pale. I think he should be colorless. I think his clothes should be this way. I think he should have this silly mustache that doesn't really convey anything except that it conveys impotence to me. It was unnecessary. And it sort of was a manifestation of what I thought his life was like at that time. Basically unnecessary, that he felt useless, invisible to the world, to society, even to himself.
A question about a very dramatic scene in an upcoming episode, which is where you're deciding or confronted with the decision of whether or not to undergo chemotherapy treatments. And your wife stages a sort of intervention and everyone's around and you take turns talking by holding a talking pillow, which gives you the right to speak. And it's a funny idea in a very dramatic scene, and you're the last to speak, and finally you get the talking pillow. And I thought, this is the first time you've had the talking pillow in four or five episodes. And how hard a scene was that for you to do, because you were quite strong in it?
The thing about an actor approaching a scene like that is you can't for a second think that what you're doing is funny. Because if you do, then there's a slight wink, wink, nod, nod to the audience. Oh, isn't this cute? We're using this talking pillow. And all of us just took this idea that this gave us the right to speak at that time and to speak uninterrupted. And it's very respectful of the audience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a laugh track to it. And if the audience finds that piece funny, as you did, David, then I think you can smile or laugh if that strikes you that way or not. And ultimately, that is just so juicy to play, because there's a whole wide range of reactions that an audience can have at any particular time, and none is wrong.
We're talking to Bryan Cranston, star of the AMC drama series Breaking Bad. Your resume fascinates me. You seem to have been in the 70s and 80s in one episode of almost everything.
Mm.
Not several episodes, just one. But, I mean, great shows like Chicago Hope and L.A. Law and 30-something and Hill Street. And then you're in Walker, Texas Ranger, Touched by an Angel, Jake and the Fat Man, and Baywatch.
Mm-hmm. A wide range of good programs and crappy ones.
That's sort of my question. But, I mean, clearly a working
actor.
Oh,
don't be embarrassed.
But how – and your first job is like on Chips, bless your soul. So, first of all, how do you get started on Chips? And then how do you balance this career?
Well, when an actor first starts out, you're looking to work, any work. You need money to pay your rent and money to pay for your 8x10 pictures and your resumes and your acting classes. So you need some film on yourself. And that's you're willing to take just about anything. And remember, in those days, I started in 1979, there was no record, no permanent record for anyone to keep track of the stuff. So you would accept a terrible show because you needed the money. And I did a movie called Amazon Women from the Moon.
Well, that was John Landis. Wasn't that John Landis?
John Landis did it, but a terrible film. But you don't care because you're not going to put it on your resume. It's like it comes and goes. But there's several things that I've done that I've removed from the resume, but now in this world of IMDb, you can't hide. There's
that's really
all
funny.
The schlock that I used to do is now coming back, and it's all right there. So it's a piece of humble pie.
See, I always thought, I mean, I know of writers and producers who have, say, taken MASH off of their resume because they don't want to seem older, which I think is a sin because it's such an incredibly good show. I never thought of just intentionally keeping something off just because it was bad and maybe nobody
Dreck.
Will notice.
Yeah, yeah.
But what do you remember about Chips?
I remember I had this terrible Southern accent. I think I was talking like this. I was talking like a special needs person relative of Gomer Pyle or something. I'll tell you, I was talking like, you know. And it was an interesting experience. I had a wife on the show named Kathy Schauer, who was apparently, and I didn't really know it at the time, she was a very pretty woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a Playboy playmate and was like, wow, Eric Estrada. That's all he had to find out. Playboy playmate. And, he was after her like nobody's business. And it's like, you know, it's interesting because I heard nothing but bad things about Eric, things saying, oh, he does this, he does this, he's, you know. And he was nice to me on the show, I must say.
Well, another bad TV show. I mean, I've been a TV critic since 75, so I can say this. Another bad show you were on, but it had a good result for you, was Airwolf. Wasn't that Jan Michael Vincent in a helicopter? Is that the one I'm thinking of, or am I confusing
that's
that?
Walking. Yeah, no, that's the one. Jan Michael Vincent on his descent into his personal hell, which was horrible. This guy was, you know, had so much promise, and he was late every day, and he had his drinking problem, his drug problem, and there was a scene where we're in a helicopter, and they're shooting what's called a poor man's process, which is a helicopter is not actually in the air. But if you shoot from a low angle up, all you see is sky behind you, and there's a couple grips in the back moving the rotor, and it looks like the whole thing is in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And there was our first AD would say, okay, roll sound speed, here we go, slate it, and Brian, and he would shake his fist to me. That would be my cue to wake up Jan.
Oh.
And to have, no, to, seriously, to wake up Jan and have him, you know, act in the scene. And it was such a shame. And I was like, God, this is so horrible, especially for a beginning actor when I was pretty new there and wanting more than anything to be able to be a part of the acting community and to have the gift that has eventually came to me to become a good working actor. And I don't take it lightly, and I don't have any expectations of what the business owes me. I have no sense of entitlement. I just work.
One thing that I find in common between your part of Hal in Malcolm in the Middle and your new part as Walter in Breaking Bad, and there isn't that much that they have in common, but it's as an actor, a total lack of vanity when it comes to attacking the characters as you see them. And I'd like to play the first scene from Malcolm in the Middle where we meet your character. You're the husband and you're down. The kids are at the breakfast table. They're trying to eat. You're nude reading a newspaper that's strategically open to cover things while you're reading it. And your wife, Jane Kaczmarek, is shaving your back hair with some hair trimmers.
Huh. Look at this. They're sending an unmanned probe to Venus and letting a bunch of school children name it. Well, that's gonna end badly.
These clippers are dull already. Honestly, Hal, you're like a monkey.
They do this every month. He has sensitive skin. The hair gets itchy under his clothes.
Yeah, it seems like such a shame to just dump this in the trash. Maybe birds would like to make nests with it, or I don't know, maybe you boys could use it for school projects. Arms up.
So that's what memories does that bring back to you? And is it true that you had to have for your first scene in a sitcom or the first scene, maybe they were shot out of sequence, but you had to have yak hair glued all over you to make that scene
yes.
work?
I have nothing but fond memories of Malcolm in the Middle. It was a fantastic period of my life. Brilliantly written by Linwood Boomer. That was the first scene. The first scene I ever shot in the pilot was the scene where I'm naked in front of all these children. And the person who's in charge of kids, you know, in taking care of them from the Coogan Law, and they have all these rights, which is fantastic now, insisted that in between scenes, I stand behind this black curtain. So apparently, while we're shooting it, my nudity was okay and didn't hurt the retinas of their little eyes. But in between, I had to go stand behind this curtain. But yes, it's true. I was, except for a modesty patch, and believe me, it was very modest, I had nothing else on. It took three makeup artists 4 hours to apply yak hair to my body. And they said it was yak hair, and they told me why. Yak hair most resembles human hair, but it's longer. So they were able to use part of it for the glue and still have part of it that is unmatted and standing out. But that meant I couldn't sit down. So for the entire day that we're shooting this, I never sat down. And I had my arms out most of the time so everything wouldn't get matted. But when it came time to actually shaving this hair off my body, the glue would get stuck in the razor and it would start to pull my skin. So we had to have a casting call for hairy back people. And they brought in all kinds of people. It looked like a carpeteria store where there was Shag and there was Lopile and there was, you know, Berber. And they picked the body type that they felt was most like mine, which is very unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And they had a body double. And it turned out to be one of our Teamster guys. Turned out to be one of the guys that we actually shaved through and did the close-up shot of the hair cutting through the – or the razor cutting through the hair, rather.
We're talking with Bryan Cranston, star of the AMC drama series Breaking Bad. One of the things I learned reading about you for this is that your parents were actors, Joe and Peggy Cranston. Would I know them from anything?
You wouldn't know my mom, and my dad might be hard to remember. I remember when my dad was he had the real actor's life. His life was up and down and up and down. And I remember him mostly dying in everything that I saw him do, from the, whether he was a soldier on top of the roof in the day that was it not the end of the world. I forget what the name of the movie was, the sci-fi movie with the large grasshoppers that took over the city. He was in that saying, Sector 8 is fine here. And we see him die, you know, or else he was an infantry man, or he was, in the cavalry and he got shot with an arrow. He was always dying. Hey, Dad's dying tonight, you know, so we'd watch him. But he met my mother in the late 40s in an acting class in Hollywood. And he was they were all in the same class with Anne Bancroft and David Janssen at the time. And it was kind of a good time for them, and post-war and everything was kind of on the upswing, and they married and decided to have children. And that's when my mom decided, well, I'll either have a career or be a mother. And those were the choices for women in those days. And she always regretted that. She always wished that she had pursued both.
One last Breaking Bad question. Do you have friends or family members who have gone through the process of chemotherapy and cancer, and if so, what did that do to your acting approach?
Yes, I do. And in fact, recently my sister-in-law went through breast cancer and would go with her to her chemotherapy sessions and her radiation sessions. And it's very traumatic. You can feel the energy. It's a palpable trepidation. And you wonder, is this now the beginning of the end of my life? And as positive as you want to remain, it's difficult. And I took that information with me, but when I weighed it against what my character Walter White was going through, it was almost a fair trade-off, because he was just living a life of existence before. And the irony to this is that ever since this death sentence of a lung cancer that is inoperable, he's been more alive and more awake than he has in the past 25 years. So he's, in an odd way, he's accepting it and willing to deal with that set of circumstances.
Bryan Cranston, it was a joy having you on Fresh Air. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
Bryan Cranston, from an interview recorded earlier this year. The star of AMC's Breaking Bad just won the Emmy as Best Actor in a Drama Series. Season 2 of Breaking Bad will premiere early next year. James McBride's 2001 novel Miracle at St. Anna was inspired by the all-black 92nd Division that fought in Italy during World War II. Now Spike Lee has adapted that book into a movie with a script written by McBride. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Spike Lee is the most prominent African-American director of all time, and he feels entitled, perhaps even obligated, to challenge the malign neglect of the past, historical accounts omitting black contributions, and the movies that passed along those myths. He recently attacked Clint Eastwood for leaving African-American soldiers out of the Iwo Jima film Flags of Our Fathers, and his new World War II epic, Miracle at St. Anna, opens with an old black man in 1983 watching John Wayne in The Longest Day on TV and muttering, "We fought for this country too." It's a naked declaration of intent, a cinematic placard. In McBride's historical novel about the all-black 92nd Infantry Division that fought in Italy, Lee clearly saw the ideal vehicle for his Flags of Our Fathers, his Saving Private Ryan, his The Longest Day. The canvas of Miracle at St. Anna is vast and impressive. What's disappointing is how heavy-handedly he fills it in. In a lurching prologue, that old black man, a post office teller, shoots an Italian man who shows up at his window. Police searching the black man's Harlem apartment find a long-lost marble head from a Florence bridge that was blown up by the Nazis. In Rome, a middle-aged man reads about the head and drops his coffee cup in slow motion. The film is a flashback to Tuscany in 1944, in which we learn why the old man killed the Italian, why he bristled at John Wayne, and why the guy in Rome dropped his coffee. Lee crams a lot in and ends up caricaturing almost everyone. His four protagonists, Buffalo Soldiers they're called, are Derek Luke as the stalwart Sergeant Stamps, Michael Ealy as the cynical ladies' man Bishop, Laz Alonso as the anxious translator Hector, and Omar Benson Miller as the huge, lovable simpleton called Train. It's Train who finds an injured Italian boy named Angelo and adopts him, carting him to a nearby village, even after Bishop says to leave him be, that all white people are trained to hate blacks. With the exception of two flashbacks, the rest of the film takes place in that village. Train bonds with the little boy. Bishop puts the moves on a gorgeous Italian, played by Valentina Servi. And everyone stands around waiting for something to happen, with no John Wayne in sight.
You, come here.
Gather the rest of whoever will come, and we'll take them down the mountain.
We do not come with you.
Why not?
Nazis in all villages.
Yeah. Boom, boom. You just sit tight, and it'll be jingle bells real soon. The U.S. Army is sitting right here in front of you.
We need army inside house now. 3 years we've been waiting. First the British, then the Americans. Italy is tired to wait.
Everything in Miracle at St. Anna is labored. The debates between the cynical blacks and hopeful blacks, the heroic Italian partisans and the sneaky fascists, the conscience-stricken Nazis and the cruel Nazis. The dialogue by novelist McBride is subtext-free, and the actors go broad when they can't go deep. Terence Blanchard's score rarely stops. It's a magnificent piece of work, but it elegizes the characters before they can open their mouths. Lee often sabotages his best ideas. In the first battle, the soldiers trudge through a river while a Nazi truck blasts the voice of Axis Sally, the German counterpart of Tokyo Rose, to entice them to surrender. Much of what she says hits home, that they're fighting for a country that once enslaved them and now keeps them down, that they're cannon fodder. But Lee can't let the words hang in the air. He shows us Axis Sally in her plush red lair, a lipsticked white temptress. Then the cartoon racist Southern colonel, miles from the scene, refuses to believe these uppity Negroes when they radio they've made it across the river, and he orders their location shelled. Lee lingers on the carnage, the men cut down by both Germans and Americans. Here and later, in a flashback to a massacre of a village, including women and little children, Lee shoves the horror in our faces. I'm sure he sees this as the stark reality of war, but atrocities in a film call for more, not less artistry. And after all that splatter, Lee ends by pouring on religious uplift. He does have his sights on Saving Private Ryan and The Longest Day. But Miracle at St. Anna often seems less about correcting their omissions than capturing their Oscars.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.